ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Are you worried about what would happen if you lost your job? You probably should be. 3 years ago, Australia was creating jobs at the rate of 60,000 per month. It's now not even 16,000. 3 years ago, there was one unemployed person for each vacant job. Now there are two. On the numbers, it's half as easy to get a job as it used to be. It could be worse. It used to be worse. Before COVID, there were three to four unemployed people for each vacant job, and the unemployment rate seemed like it would never fall below 5%. It's now well below, and it seems like it might stay there. To get an idea of what's about to happen, it's good to look back at what just happened, at the biggest rearrangement of the labour market in half a century, with the future now dimly visible. Welcome to The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and my guest this week, Jeff Borland, who not only examines the official employment statistics each month at the University of Melbourne, but has also just completed the first comprehensive examination of the five-year earthquake to Australian employment that was COVID. And Tom Crowley, a former Commonwealth Treasury economist who now works for the ABC in Parliament House and was at the Grattan Institute when the earthquake began. Welcome, Jeff. Welcome back, Tom.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jeff.
Jeff, unemployment has been trending up all year. It's now around 4.4%. It was 4.5% in September, 4.3% in October. It's well above the 3.5%, the low it hit as the lockdowns ended and the economy roared back to life. But it's still well below 5%. We've just had an anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the sacking of the Whitlam government. And just before that, the year before that, unemployment jumped from 2% to 5%. And that's more or less been the floor ever since, until recently. Can you paint a picture of the broad sweep of employment over those past 50 years?
Yeah, as you said, between May 74 and May 75, the rate of unemployment, which had been around about 2% pretty steadily for the previous 15 years, jumped from about 2% to 5%, stayed around there, jumped again to about 10% when we had a recession from about 1981 to 83. We got it back down to 6% during the 1980s, but then in the recession that we had to have of the early 90s, it jumped up to 11.2%. We then had the long boom, which finished with the mining boom, where we actually got the rate of unemployment back down to 4%.
Briefly.
Yeah, briefly, not for as long a period as we have now. With the unwinding of the mining boom, the rate jumped up to about 5 or 6%, where it stayed during the 2010s.
Until COVID. Now, things are actually better than those figures suggest because we've now got many more two-earner families. We used to not really count the second earners as unemployed. Now we do. What's been the extent of that improvement?
Well, yeah, it's an important point, Peter, because, yeah, obviously we care about the rate of unemployment. The rate of unemployment tells us the extent to which we could have more people in employment. But yeah, it's a comparison that really matters. Like if you look at Australia and the US, in August 2025, both countries had unemployment rates of 4.3%. So you'd say, okay, you know, their labour markets look sort of similar. But in Australia, the employment population rate was, well, we had 64% of our population in employment, whereas in the US, it was only 59.5%. So unemployment obviously really matters, but yeah, if you want to get a full picture of the labour market, you also need to ask, you know, what proportion of the population are in employment.
Tom, last week at a conference in Sydney, the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank displayed an extraordinary graph, a graph of Australia's success. It was Australia's employment to population ratio over the last few years compared to that of every other comparable country.
If you plot Australia there, employment population ratio on the left, you can see that every other comparable country has moved downwards, in some cases really quite sharply. You see New Zealand there, for example. Australia is that plateau, the blue one on the left.
Australia's employment to population ratio has remained well above its pre-COVID average, whereas the lines for Germany, the United Kingdom, the United States, New Zealand, Canada and Switzerland are all heading down. Tom, is this luck or design? What do you think Australia's done right?
I'm not sure if luck or design are necessarily the only two options, but perhaps some sort of, a happy accident that relates maybe to something else. Because I guess your question goes to not just what we've been talking about, why the ratio is so high in Australia, but a lot of the elements of the story that we've teased out so far could just as easily be true in other countries. So why us so exceptionally? And I'd be interested in Jeff's thoughts on this, the extent to which an Albanese Labor government coming in with a particular focus on care, aged care, child care, disability care, and in particular championing through the Fair Work Commission process, wage rises for which the federal government is ultimately on the hook for these care workers, but also just significantly expanding the need for a care workforce. The non-market jobs and the growth in kind of health jobs writ large is another chart that you can show where Australia looks quite remarkable compared to everyone else in the labour force. So I wonder whether that might be part of the story.
Jeff, many of us like to put COVID out of our minds. The crisis began with a shock. Employment dived faster than ever before. You've said hours worked dived 10% in a single month. Between March and May 2020, employment fell 875,000. That means 750,000 Australians lost their jobs. What happened next during COVID?
Well, what happened next after that shock was that we had what I've called a fast but bumpy recovery. Fast in that whenever the threat of COVID retreated, the economy regained jobs at an incredibly fast pace. So actually between May 2020 and May 2021, we then went on to add over 1 million people into employment.
We more than bounced back in the same time.
We'd more than bounce back. But of course, that's kind of choosing the high points because Victoria and New South Wales were both about to go into shutdown again because of the Delta variant. So I call it fast but bumpy because when the threat of COVID wasn't around, the expansion in employment was amazing. We've never seen employment decrease that quickly in March to May. We'd never seen employment increase that quickly. But it was bumpy because then we went backwards. Victoria and New South Wales, obviously being the biggest states, the negative hits to employment in those states when the Delta variant occurred meant that we went backwards. But then by the end of 2021, we to some degree got those under control. The important thing was that enough people had been vaccinated by then that the economy was able to reopen. So by the end of 2021, we were back slightly above where we'd been before COVID. Then I guess I call sort of the next year of 2022 full steam ahead. International borders reopened. We were still seeing the impact of the fiscal stimulus in the economy and labour market. And so we had, really a continuation of the very fast pace of employment growth we'd seen in the recovery from the initial impact of COVID. So that was 2022. Then 2023, 24, I call slowing slowly, in that the rate of employment growth eased, but obviously was still strong enough to sustain a rate of unemployment that was at historically low level.
And Tom alluded to this, the nature of the jobs, that is the nature of the new jobs that have been created is very different. You've called them non-market jobs. Elsewhere, you've referred to non-routine cognitive jobs. Those new jobs, What are they like?
So the non-market, which is the point Tom was making to do with care jobs, for example, that's just incredibly, incredibly important. From the sort of June quarter of 2021 to the end of 2024, which is the period that I look at in the review that you mentioned, non-market employment grew by 22%, market employment grew by about 5.5%. Worth saying, what do we mean by non-market employment? It's a term that the ABS uses to denote three industries: healthcare, social assistance, education and training, and public administration and safety. Sometimes, yeah, not all public sector jobs, they're often referred to as sort of government-funded jobs.
Because the government pays for aged care even if it doesn't provide it.
Exactly, exactly. Or they pay for a lot of medical services even if it's private practitioners sort of providing them. So that's what we mean by the non-market sector. And if you say, well, what if non-market employment had only increased at the same rate as market employment, so that's all those other industries, you know, manufacturing, construction, trade and that, then we would have had 700,000 less people employed at the end of 2024 than we actually had. The proportion of people in employment would have been about 2.5 percentage points less. So when you kind of go back to you're asking Tom about the deputy governor's speech, well, I think, yeah, good policy directed at dealing with COVID has been an important element of our success in the, or the strong labour market in the last few years. You just wouldn't have had Australia's labour market in this position if, as Tom said, you didn't have a Labor government coming in with an agenda to put funds into the care economy. I mean, that coincidence has been, of timing, has been essential to understanding what's happened in the labour market.
Does this mean, Tom, that Jim Chalmers is right? Most unusually for a treasurer, treasurers always say, we created this many jobs. This is one of these rare instances where it's probably true.
It probably is, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that's not necessarily actually really the way that the government would like to present the narrative. They seem to be copping a lot of political flack over the last year or two for the fact that these were non-market jobs. They've been very keen to point to the signs sort of more recently that it's the private sector that's doing more of the work, because there was some sense in the political narrative that if these were, you know, government-funded jobs, the unemployment outcomes were in a sense illegitimate or not something the government could claim credit for. So there's some, I guess, a little bit of a paradox there that maybe says more about politics than anything else. But yeah, you know, I think there definitely is an argument for it, although, as perhaps we'll come to it, as some implications as well for how we think about productivity and wages.
I think it is important to say that this isn't just sort of Keynes' example of getting people to dig holes and that to, you know, get us out of sort of an unemployment slump or what would have been. You know, some people have said, well, is this a recipe for policy in the future? The RBA increases interest rates, but then the government does job creation. And I don't think it is, because the really important point here is that the government said, look, there's a really important sort of social purpose in increasing employment in these areas. And so it's kind of, to me, it's a happy coincidence. And it is really important, the point that, you know, these jobs are doing something that, I guess, voters decided was going to be really valuable socially.
As a man, I've got to ask, we're all men, as it happens, unusually on this program, what's it doing for men, Jeff? These jobs are jobs typically overwhelmingly filled by women.
It's interesting. In the 2010s, we had the traditional story, which was that male labour force participation was decreasing or steady. Female labour force participation was increasing. That was what was driving the growth in overall labour force participation. But since 2020, female increasing participation is still the main factor driving aggregate participation. But increased male participation has also contributed about one third of the higher proportion of people who are looking for work.
Does this mean we're actually getting male care workers to a greater degree than we were?
Yeah. So then you say, well, what are those males doing? And it does seem that one of the things they're doing is working in healthcare and social assistance to a greater extent than had been the case before. So healthcare and social assistance is still, to use the terminology, female-dominated industry. But the proportion of male employment in that industry went from about 21.5% to 25% between late 2019 and late 2024. And that's kind of 73,000 extra jobs. So it seems like one of the drivers drivers, perhaps the main driver of this increase in male participation during COVID, is the growth of that sector and males' increasing willingness or capacity to work in that industry.
Tom, one thing that we learn should happen is that when demand for workers explodes, wages explode. We've created almost 1 million more jobs in the past 3 years, yet real wages have fallen. What's going on?
Well, I'm going to quote from Jeff Borland, as it happens. I mean, I think that Jeff's paper, which maybe we can talk a little bit more about, steps through a few of the reasons why this might be the case. The one that I found...
Is it that you can't bargain if you're in one of those care jobs? Might that be it?
Well, in part, I mean, I think, and Jeff could talk to that a little bit, I think the broader story that you tease out quite well in this paper, Jeff, is this sense in which Australia's institutions meant that wages were maybe not as kind of responsive in an automatic, swift way to changes in economic conditions as they might otherwise have been.
By institutions, you mean enterprise bargaining? And
yeah, so enterprise bargaining, right, if you're on an EBA, I mean, at the ABC, one is being negotiated as we speak, and they cover a period of 3 years and they're only revisited at the end of the
year. It's a slow, painful process.
Indeed.
And it was introduced by the Labor government of Paul Keating and has slowed down wage growth recently.
And one in five workers, particularly low-paid workers in sort of hospitality, retail and some care jobs, they're on awards. They are revisited once a year by the Fair Work Commission, and then you've got people who are on individual agreements who may or may not have been able to carve out something to kind of claw their way back over this elevated inflation. So each one of those three things, I think this is kind of interesting in a sense, you had a kind of a muted wage response to the hot economic conditions.
I mean, maybe to give people sort of an idea of why we'd be saying about the timing of wage changes. So when I was doing economics as a high school student, one of the highlights was that we would get to every 3 months, if it was during school time, we'd get to go to the school's TV room. That tells you about how long ago I went to high school. We'd get to go to the TV room and watch the quarterly decision of the Commonwealth Arbitration Commission on wage indexation.
No one will believe that now. Wages were adjusted every 3 months in a judicial hearing.
Wages were adjusted every 3 months in line with inflation. And so, you know, it's no surprising then that we had wage inflation, spiral at that time. Now, as Tom said, you know, we've got these three wage setting methods. There's individual agreements where you could, in theory, sort of argue for a wage increase as soon as the labour market gets tighter and you've got higher price inflation. But then we've got people on awards whose wages are only adjusted once a year through the minimum wage review, the Fair Work Commission making that decision. And then we've got large proportion of people on enterprise bargaining agreements who their wages are locked in sort of 2 or 3 years ahead. And so if you use the wage price index, which is the standard measure used, real wages are 4.6% behind where they were in December 2019. So arguably, there's still a bit of distance to catch up.
Putting the picture together, we're more likely to be care workers, we're less likely to be getting wage rises, and at least we have jobs for the moment. Putting the picture together is what we do on The Economy Stupid on ABC Radio National with me, Peter Martin, and guest this week, Labor expert at the University of Melbourne, Jeff Borland, and ABC Federal political reporter, Tom Crowley. Can we turn to what we've learned from COVID? Jeff, you referred to COVID as a natural experiment because we're able to get a clear read on the things that were changing quickly. Tom, is one of the lessons that we've learned from COVID that if we want to, if we really want to, we can stop unemployment climbing? That's what we did. Massive government spending, big interest rate cuts, and we did it for the second time. We did it during the global financial crisis as well. Is low unemployment now within the government's power to provide?
I think that that's probably a reasonable way of putting it. I mean, maybe what I would say is that our economic institutions, I think actually, and maybe this fact isn't appreciated or this point isn't made enough, actually did a pretty good job with both phases of a crisis. You know, I think firstly, and this is a little bit off our topic for today, but in terms of Treasury and the federal government and the RBA responding to the immediate downturn in COVID. Now, there's an argument that with the JobKeeper program and others that there was a little bit of overstimulus. But I think when you talk to key players who were involved in designing this, what was certainly successful was that a method of stimulus that stopped kind of a broader loss of confidence was gotten out and gotten into action pretty quickly. Something was stood up that could work under fire. And at the end of the day, you know, it did a reasonably good job of sort of preserving a lot of employment relationships that might not otherwise have been there. So I think there's a reasonable enough, you know, kind of pass mark on that regard. Then, of course, you do get a little bit of economic heat. Part of that's coming from overseas. Maybe you can say part of that's coming from the stimulus, et cetera, et cetera. But the second line of defence, which is how do you respond to a period of overheating in the economy, was actually carried off pretty well in a plan from the RBA to increase rates, not as high as others, with the hope of avoiding a significant spike in unemployment, avoiding some of the pitfalls maybe of the previous decade and the response to the global financial crisis, but with the consequence that rates would be not quite as high, but high for longer. And maybe this conversation that we're having about wages as well being maybe more muted in the short term, but slightly elevated now in this period that we're seeing. I think actually, you know, that was really how the scenario was presented from the RBA at the very beginning of this, and it's panned out reasonably steadily. I feel like I've been saying in various forums for 2 or 3 years, you know, this is the narrow path, this is the plan, this is what it's going to look like. And apart from a few bumps on the road, you know, it has more or less gone to plan at this stage.
Jeff, years ago, John Maynard Keynes referred to economists as dentists. He said he looked forward to the day when economists were like dentists. They fixed things. They followed rules and they fixed things. Is that sort of where we are in employment? that we know how to do things now?
Well, I think the last, you know, 30 years or so has been a very successful period of economic policy making in Australia. The Asian financial crisis, the GFC, then dealing with COVID. I think, yeah, policymakers have by and large done an extremely good job.
Although we discovered during COVID they could do a much better job. That is to say, we had thought that 5% was the floor under unemployment and they'd acted that way, and then we discovered it wasn't.
No, I agree with that as well, that hopefully one thing that's come out of this period is it's changed society's expectations and through that sort of changed policymakers' expectations about what the rate of unemployment that we should be aiming for is. But, you know, I wouldn't be saying that we're in Keynes's dentist's world yet. The economy has a way of sort of jumping up and surprising us. I think, you know, if you go back to the early 90s, there we had a situation where we were hit by a very large negative event for the economy, and policymakers, you know, didn't sort of have so much idea of how to deal with that. So I think the last 30 years we've been in a sort of relatively stable environment, and I think in stable environments it does become sort of easier to manage the economy, but still requires a lot of skill. I don't want to make out that it's easy. Our policymakers are, you know, highly capable and obviously highly devoted to the task, but that in the last 30 years has relied on sort of, you know, knowing what to do because we understood the environment. But, you know, like we saw in the 70s and 80s, the economy every now and then throws up completely new environments, and that makes it more difficult.
It did 50 years ago, so it might again.
Exactly, exactly.
What's your advice now for someone looking for a job? I ask that because we're creating jobs at half the rate we were in the middle of the year. What do you think the future holds? What should someone do? I suppose one thing you should do is if you've got a job, stay in it, perhaps a bit longer than you might have.
Well, it is the case that there's, like, it's correct that there's less growth in employment, you know, right at the moment than there was, say, 2024 or there was in 2023. But, yeah, there's still a lot of jobs being created. The absolute amount of workers moving job to job is still, you know, there's still a lot of people who move jobs. So I don't think, you know, if you're in a job and you think that there's a job you'd like to do more, or I don't think there's a particular reason for being deterred from job switching. I guess for people who are younger, who kind of make up a disproportionate share of the group of people who are, looking for work because they're making the transition from education to work. Yeah, for them, I guess it's really important to understand that the labour market is creating less jobs at the moment than it was the last couple of years. And so it's not if finding it hard to get a job, it's not to do with them. It's this labour market effect. And so I think persistence is sort of a really important thing when the labour market is weaker. But yeah, the labour market's still creating jobs. The rate of unemployment is still low. The vacancy rate is still relatively high. So yeah, it's still not a bad environment to be sort of trying to get into work or looking for a new job.
What's your advice, Tom?
Maybe I'll be a little facetious and give some advice that I haven't followed, which is work with your hands. I think that the construction pipeline that we have coming in the next few years, particularly any energy transmission lines and homes, we need a much larger construction workforce than we have. Maybe you could also say that that's a sector that's less prone to the sort of turbulence and disruption we might be about to see in some information jobs due to artificial intelligence. I mean, that's a whole other discussion exactly what that, how we should think about that. But I think, picking up a trade might be something that we need more of in the next few years.
I think that's such good advice, Tom. The reason I think that is because everyone, and I know Jeff is someone who says this, says education is the key. There are many forms of education, many forms, as economists call it, of increasing your human capital. Before we go, as is traditional on the program, anything to look out for in the days and weeks ahead? Jeff?
Well, I guess not necessarily the most exciting sort of reading for the beach, but as a labour economist, I've got to say the monthly labour force statistics, I think, looking at the extent to which the job creation or employment growth sort of stays as it is or weakens is going to be really, really important for how the RBA decides to move on interest rates. So I think, just in the coming several months, getting a track on sort of what's happening to employment, what's happening to the rate of unemployment is going to have very important policy implications.
Tom?
Well, the last week is coming up in federal parliament. The last sitting week for the year is next week. It's the week known as the killing season because it's often when leaders of political parties get knocked off. No prizes for guessing which political leader might be sitting a little nervously as we head into this week. That's all a little bit of a politics circus. But one of the things that has an economic implication that might get caught up in it is this reform to the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act, the environmental approvals framework. Ken Henry says that it is the single biggest productivity challenge for Australia to get the balance right in these laws of protecting our environment on the one hand, but being able to kind of get major projects going without undue delay.
And that might be sorted out next week.
Well, in a world where Susan Lee's position was assured, I think Labor was pretty confident about the way that they were progressing towards a deal with the coalition on this, and they believed that ultimately she was the kind of leader that they could work on. There was also some sense that moderates within the party were running dead a little bit on net zero in their own internal discussions as a bit of a bargaining chip to say, well, look, if we can't get net zero, maybe you can agree that we can deal with Labor over all of this. But if Susan Lee gets turfed out, and a more conservative figure like Andrew Hastie comes in, all bets are off and things are reset and we may have to wait until next year or even longer before we get this act passed. So Labor is really hoping that they can get this one through before Susan is ousted, as everyone now thinks that she will be. That'll be one to watch.
Tom Crowley, lapsed economist, now reporter at the ABC Political Bureau in Parliament House. Jeff Borland, a distinguished fellow of the Economic Society of Australia and an expert in labour economics at the University of Melbourne. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Peter and Tom.
Thanks, Peter and Jeff. And I should add to that biography that Jeff was my economics lecturer. So it's great to be chatting to you again, Jeff. And if I sound a little nervous, that might be why.
Well, you're one of our star honours students, so yeah, always great to catch up.
Thank you for listening. You can find our episodes on the ABC Listen app or on ABC Radio National Thursdays. If you have any thoughts or questions or comments, no economic question is stupid. You can email us theeconomy.stupid@abc.net.au. We've received quite a few emails about our discussion on insurance last week. A lot of you are happy with your insurer. Thanks to producer Sam Carmody. I'm Peter Martin. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.